Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18 plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointsTC.
Screen Time with John Fardy. This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Screen Time. I'm John Fardy and this is News Talk's TV and movie show. This week on the show, You Can't Kill the Bogeyman. Yes, a new book all about the Halloween horror series. We're joined by author Wayne Byrne. In a bumper week for new releases, we review After the Hunt with Julia Roberts and Colin Farrell in Ballad of a Small Player. Not to mention the return of the Black Phone. You can email the show screentime@newstalk.com. This show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com or wherever you get your podcasts. And it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. here on News Talk. Good weekend to you all. And I do hope you're doing well. I told you before, I'm doing the Dublin Marathon Sunday week, and I bore you for 30 seconds, but we are now in what's called taper phase, where you're slowing down, running less, resting your amazing body before the off. But this is the phase where you are terrified of one of two things, getting injured or getting a cold, because you've been training for the guts of 4 months now, running 3, 4, maybe sometimes 5 times a week. And you've put a lot of work in, probably. And the thoughts of getting a cold or twisting your foot or something are terrifying, I find. So, you know, should you see me in the street and know who I am, please don't cough on me. If my children get a cold in the next week, I'm going to go live in a hotel for the duration. I'm sorry, that's what marathons do to people. Now, by the time we came off air last week, we hadn't heard the sad news of the passing of Diane Keaton.
Natasha, to love is to suffer. To avoid suffering, one must not love. But then one suffers from not loving. Therefore, to love is to suffer. Not to love is to suffer. To suffer is to suffer. To be happy is to love. To be happy, then, is to suffer, but suffering makes one unhappy. Therefore, to be unhappy, one must love or love to suffer or suffer from too much happiness. I hope you're getting this down.
Ah, yes, Diane Keaton in Woody Allen's Love and Death, giving a funny yet heartfelt speech about love. As I say, Diane Keaton passed away. We got news last Sunday, and I cannot start a film show without mentioning her, because she was quite simply one of the great comedic and straight actresses of all time. For Manny and for winning an Oscar, she'll always be remembered as Annie Hall, which is one of the great comedic performances of all time by a woman or a man. She was equally great in Manhattan, where she played a different character as a complicated love interest for a couple of people in that movie. She was Kay, of course, in The Godfather. She voiced Finding Dory and Finding Nemo. She was the voice up later in her career, things like The First Wives Club, Something's Gotta Give, which was a huge commercial success, where she's the love interest, the reluctant love interest on both sides of Jack Nicholson. She was a delightful screen presence, being it funny or serious. A delightful interviewee by all accounts as well. I never had the chance, unfortunately, but she was a classic actress, even though when she arrived on the scene, her style seemed very modern. But she is quite simply one of the greats. So RIP the wonderful Diane Keaton. Now, another serious talent was this guy.
I'm a Mog. Half man, half dog.
Gus Polinski, Polka King of the Midwest.
Del Griffith, Director of Sales, Shower Curtain Ring Division.
This is a lovable guy. This is a guy who, the minute you see his face, you're going to smile.
He was amazingly funny.
Thank you.
He was one of the top performers out of all of them.
Guess my secret to acting would be I pretend real hard.
Even though John did distinctly different characters, John was always there.
He was so gentlemanly and so Canadian.
Nobody had bigger expectations for himself than John.
And then all of a sudden, it kind of jumped
to a different level.
I've made winning my whole life. And when you make winning your whole life, you have to keep on winning.
You've been in more turkeys than a stuffing mix.
I think the weight of everything he was doing was just too much.
A hazard of this business is that it's very unhealthy for people pleasers.
You can't really do favors for people.
It's a bottomless cup of coffee.
If you go a whole lifetime eating your feelings, drinking your feelings, smoking your nerves, it shows up.
Yes, now that is a clip from John Candy, I Like Me, which came out last Friday on Amazon Prime. And it is a documentary about John Candy. John Candy was a fascinating guy, a beloved actor for some of his, largely, you know, his comedies, which were his stack and trade, from Uncle Buck, Planes, Trains and Automobiles, Cool Runnings. And this details that career. It has very starry contributors. Bill Murray, who doesn't do much of these things. Mel Brooks, Dan Aykroyd, Tom Hanks, Eugene Levy, Steve Martin, Conan O'Brien, Martin Short. This is starry. And it's all people saying they love him. So if there's a criticism of this, it's very much people saying how wonderful he was. But you know what? I'm fine with that. He is such a pleasant presence. We do also get a bit about his life and times. He suffered the loss of his father at a very early age, and that stayed with him all his life. He kind of became an adult early, wanted to possibly be a football player, but that didn't work out, and found he had a gift for comedy, joined the fabled Second City in Canada, then graduated to movies. And the rest is history. What we have also in this documentary is, I suppose, some of his challenges. He ate a bit too much at times. He drank a bit too much at times. He smoked a bit too much at times. Now, it wasn't, you know, I'm not saying, yay, he was the right side of addiction. But I just mean he wasn't going around arguing with people or showing up drunk on sets or any of that kind of stuff. He just didn't take care of himself at times. And it seemed to be his way of coping with a lot of stress. He also seemed to end up in certain poor movies because he was doing people favors. He kind of promised them that he would be in movies. Who makes career moves out of favors? Well, he did. And what comes across in this is that he was just a lovely guy. He died very young. His kids, both of his children, his son and daughter, are a big part of this, which is always a good sign. They're happy to talk about him. He, you know, was overweight at times, which is of no real consequence. I mean, it was to him, but so bizarre in the 80s, what you could say to people on TV shows, because he was constantly asked about it, to the point that this mild-mannered, pleasant guy would sometimes, rightly so, bite back. But what we have, first and foremost, in this, and what makes it worth watching, is lots of clips from some of those beloved movies like Planes, Trains and Automobiles. And what you forget about that movie sometimes is there is a really sad story at the heart of that. It's so wistful and melancholy as well as being very funny. So I found this a delightful watch. John Candy, I Like Me, on Amazon Prime, or Prime Video, as we're meant to call it these days. And a delightful watch. It is starry, but who cares? He's celebrated, and he should have been celebrated, and he should be celebrated. John Candy, I Like Me, on Prime Video. Now, one other thing I want to tell you about is The Return of the Diplomat on Netflix. This is Kerry Russell, Rufus Swale, who we spoke to for the last season, season two, where Kerry Russell plays a diplomat, an ambassador to the UK. And in the first two seasons, all sorts of political mad things went on. The show's occasionally daft, but it's very, very watchable. Rufus Swale plays Kerry Russell's husband, and they have a really strange relationship because he used to be an ambassador and things went a bit funny. And they're kind of this power couple with a very complicated relationship who kind of smell each other's armpits, but also possibly engage in extracurricular activities with other people. They have a strange marriage, but it is a great show. And season three has just landed. And here's the thing, folks. I've watched four episodes, and by God, it's a hell of a watch so far. I was starting to think, we've possibly seen enough of this as I enjoyed the first two seasons. But season three gets off to a about turn and grabs you by the seat of the pants. Now, some reviews are giving away something that happens in the first episode, which changes the whole dynamic of the show. But I'm not going to, because I think it's a real spoiler that needs to be avoided. So be content in the fact that if you like season one and season two, based on the first four episodes, season three is even better. And Allison Janney, who played the vice president of America in season two, is back, and she's terrific in it. So a massive thumbs up for the first half of season three of The Diplomat. Diplomat fans, you're in for a real treat. Now, there is a bumper selection of new movies opening in the cinema this week. So after the break, we will be getting into all those with Brian Lloyd. Now you're welcome back to Screen Time News Talk's TV and movie show. We turn to the week's new cinema releases, and by golly, there's a lot of them. But thankfully, we have entertainment journalist and host of the Screenland podcast, Brian Lloyd, to rattle through them. We're going to be talking about the new Julia Roberts Me Too campus movie, After the Hunt, the follow-up to the successful and somewhat acclaimed Black Phone, Black Phone 2, imaginative title, and Ballad of a Small Player with Colin Farrell, being directed by Edward Berger, the man who gave us Conclave. Brian, hello, sir. I know you've had a busy day, so thank you for joining us.
No worries.
So listen, After the Hunt, you know, Julia Roberts, any Julia Roberts movie is a big deal. This is Luca Guadagnino directing. It's about a Me Too incident of sorts on a college campus. So there's a lot of interest in this.
There is, isn't there? Yeah. I mean, the fact that it's Luca Guadagnino, the fact that it's Julia Roberts, you have Andrew Garfield, Iowa DeBerry, and just the subject matter itself, you know, like there's been a few films that have kind of tried to address, I suppose, you know, the nebulous nature of cancel culture and all the rest of it. I mean, the one that would stick out in my mind and the one that was on my mind as I was watching this was Todd Fields' Tar with Cate Blanchett from a couple of years ago. And, you know, what that film did so well, I thought, was that it really boiled it down into a character piece in that, you know, Cate Blanchett's character, Tara, was just this monster that just wanted to control everything and everyone and everything about herself. And, you know, the nature of her relationships with people was predicated on her need to dominate and control, you know? And whereas, you know, in After the Hunt, what's going on in this is that Andrew Garfield plays this assistant professor of philosophy along with Julia Roberts. Julia Roberts' TA is played by Iowa DeBerry, who is, you know, this very wealthy young woman whose parents have contributed to the college that they're in. It's Yale. And she kind of has a little position of privilege in that she's been taken on by Julia Roberts' character and has been set by the powers that be in the college to monitoring Iowa DeBerry. And then one night, Andrew Garfield brings Iowa DeBerry back to his apartment, and Iowa DeBerry the next day accuses Andrew Garfield of raping her. And then it kind of goes into slightly sort of a whodunit, if you like, or how, you know, like as in, you know, did he actually cross the line? You know, we see him being overly familiar with her, but we see him being overly familiar with other people. And, you know, she decides, or not decides, but she kind of in her, the haze of everything, she doesn't get a rape kit done, so she doesn't have any physical evidence. And when Iowa DeBerry tries to bring her into the case, Julia Roberts is reticent because she says, you know, the last time I saw you, you were walking off with him willingly. And, you know, I don't know. I wasn't in the room, so I don't know what I saw. And I don't know what happened between you. So it's your word against his. And, you know, and I mean, these are all very, you know, these are all very real things, and it's very nebulous. And it can be very difficult for directors to try and kind of address them. You know, you could kind of take
I was going to ask, that sounds like an intriguing setup and certainly meaty, but is it, you know, and this is even a harsh thing to ask, but this is a film show, is this a satisfying film?
No, and this is my point, is that like it doesn't even try to kind of take it on in a sort of Rashomon kind of thing of, you know, what is truth? You saw one thing, I saw another thing, and, you know, it doesn't even do that. It just tries to kind of weasel its way through the story and then try to kind of bring in, you know, cancel culture writ large, and like, you know, people are being tried by the court of public opinion, and it's just a good chunk for like 95% of this film, you are being shown the dumbest version of the idea. Okay. You know what I mean? Like, it's very ham-fisted. It is very clunky in how it approaches this idea compared to something like Tar. You know? And then the film annoyingly redeems itself in the last 5 minutes okay. where it jumps forward to today into the current climate where, you know, cancel culture, as I've always understood it to be, cancel culture is a myth. Because look at somebody like Donald Trump, who was credibly accused and, you know, was convicted of, you know, horrible, horrible crimes against women and is now the president of the United States. So how real is cancel culture if he's allowed to be the leader of the
free
world?
I take your point, and not that he's listening. He would argue they were civil cases, which sure. he was found guilty. But yes, point, but that's notwithstanding.
And that's what I'm saying to you. Like, the film comes up to this point where it's like, yeah, this whole thing of cancel culture never really existed in the first okay. place. It was just a sort of mythology, if you like. And, you know, that's really interesting, you know, that sort of way. Like, that's a really interesting take on it, the fact that the film ends and all this has gone away. Mm. And you're kind of left with, like, God, why did it take you 2.5 hours nearly to get to this point where you actually do have something interesting to say, but you just have to try wrap it up in 5 minutes? And I mean, like, you know, I don't think Luca Guadagnino, I don't think he's good at taking on thorny issues. You know, he's better at taking on, I think, emotionally complex stories. Like, look at Call Me By Your Name. Look at even, you know, Queer, what he did with Daniel Craig recently at the start of the year. You know, he's able to do very emotionally complex films, but I don't think he's able to do narratively or tonally complex films. You know what I mean? Like, this is a very complex film.
What about the performances, Julia Roberts?
Yeah. She's good. I mean, like, obviously Julia Roberts is very good at, you know, taking on thorny subjects, you know, that sort of way. Like, and yes. I do think Ayoade Debiri was the weak link here. And I think she's a great actor. I think she's fantastic. I think she's the best thing about The Bear. You know, even something like Opus that she did, again, earlier in the year, it wasn't a good movie, but she was good in it. In this, though, I felt like she was miscast. Andrew Garfield, though, I think he was great as this sort of cornered rat who is, you know, lashing out at everyone. And Michael Stuhlbarg is in there as well, who I just love him in anything.
Yeah.
And he's always good. He's always, you know, worth the watch. Yeah, I mean, the performances were good, but they were just trapped in this really poorly written story, you know?
Yeah. Well, look, meaty ideas, but it took a very long time, far too long, to get to an interesting conclusion. So what are you going to say stars-wise for After the Hunt, which is in cinemas from this Friday?
2 out of 5.
2 out of 5. We'll take a quick clip of After the Hunt.
Why are you so tight? All your generation, everyone in your generation, you're so tight. Oh, right.
Thank you.
Sorry.
Perfect. Exemplar.
What are you scared of? Scared of saying the wrong thing or offending someone? When did offending someone become the preeminent cardinal sin?
I mean, I don't have a date exactly, but maybe it's around the same time your generation started making sweeping generalizations about ours.
Are you scared that we're going to think less of you if it isn't perfect? Whatever shame you have around your self-expression, it is, it's false.
A clip there from After the Hunt, which Brian Lloyd, who's chatting to me about the week's new cinema releases, gave 2 stars to. Something almost 180 degrees different, I'm assuming, is Black Phone 2, the follow-up to the 2021 reasonably successful and unexpected horror success of Black Phone. What's happening in this one? There's still a phone, presumably.
There is still a phone. Yes, there is still a phone. So if you remember from the first one, Ethan Hawke, which was kind of, this was a bit of a break for him in terms of, you know, his previous roles. He was playing this serial killer called The Grabber that seemed to specialize in taking young kids. And the film, the original film, had this sort of time traveling phone where people would pick up these two kids played by Mason Thames and Madeline McGraw would pick up the phone and they'd hear the voices of the victims of the grabber. He obviously dies, the grabber dies at the end of the first film, but it's set a few years after the fact, and the children are still terrorized by the memory of it. And they are drawn to this winter kids camp where it has a connection with their mother who died in before the events of the first film. And also as well, the origin of the grabber and where he comes from. So like right away, and you know, the grabber is still there and he's still able to attack them, but through dreams. And if you're thinking of, you know, Nightmare on Elm Street or Friday the 13th, there are a lot of references and there are a lot of kind of touch points to it. But also as well, like the story kind of goes into this idea of, you know, trauma that isn't confronted will continue to have power over you. And, you know, that's again, kind of meaty stuff. But again, that's a very, very common theme in horror, you know? And I don't know. I just didn't really feel like the execution of this was all that it could have been.
So the first one was kind of a surprise hit and kind of creepy, if memory serves. It's been a long time since I saw it. Well, 4 years. But this one is less successful.
I think so,
Maybe you didn't like the first one, though, did you?
I thought it was okay. I thought it was fine. I mean, I thought Ian Hawke was good in it. It was good to see him kind of throw himself into something like this. I mean, you know, Scott Derrickson, who directed this and directed the first one as well, you know, he's got a real eye for horror, I think. But it felt like in The Black Phone 2 that he was just going for the easy sort of thing. You know, it's that thing I call it jump. I call it like foghorn horror. Where it's just, you know, they're like, it's a big loud noise and you're kind of jump out of your seat, and it's very cheap and it's a very easy way to kind of get you to kind of be on edge, as opposed to, you know, building atmosphere, building a sense of dread, pulling you into it. And the film doesn't really do that. It's just very sort of like, you know, gory kills here and there. It does kind of rely a lot on you knowing a lot about the first movie, which, you know, as much as it was a big success or whatever, I don't know if it had the same kind of cultural cachet that, you know, The Conjuring or Halloween has had, you know?
Yeah, no, definitely. We'll actually be talking about Halloween later in the show because there's a new book called You Can't Kill the Bogeyman out, 13 movies and counting. But anyway, and so Foghorn Scares, so you weren't creeped out or really frightened by any of this then?
Not really, no. And to be honest as well, like the fact that Ethan Hawke, I would bet money on it. He wasn't on set one day of this film. All he was doing was just he was just doing voice recording from a trailer on another movie. Because you don't see his face in it at all. Like, he wears this kind of mask thing. Again, you know, bringing in Michael Myers and all the rest, but bringing in the hockey mask of Jason Voorhees, just kind of tapping into that very rich iconography of horror protagonists or antagonists, I should say.
Yeah, okay. Are we heading for another 2 stars?
It is, unfortunately.
Yeah, I had a feeling. Okay, look, it's not your fault. I mean, it's Hollywood's fault, clearly. Brian Lloyd is giving 2 stars to Black Phone 2. Okay, the final movie up for discussion. Can we redeem ourselves? Let's take a quick clip.
Mr. Riley. You stole a considerable sum of money from a client.
I've made some mistakes. Right, who hasn't?
You have 24 hours.
I'm not a criminal.
You stole that money from a helpless old woman. No more credit.
Look. I find myself in a bit of a bind.
You're just a nice working class Irish boy. In way over his head.
I'm about to win big, and when I do, I won't just pay my debts off, I'll pay yours too.
What I see is a man way beyond any redemption.
That was Colin Farrell in Ballad of a Small Player. This was directed by Edward Berger. It's in cinemas from this weekend and will be on Netflix a couple of weeks later, which would lead us to believe Oscars could be in the air, or that's certainly often the rationale where why streamers show movies in cinemas. So he's playing a low-level gambling addict in Macau.
Yeah, and he's kind of constructed this character for himself called Lord Doyle, who sounds like a fast show character, looks and sounds like a fast show character.
Right.
Paul Whitehouse, 13th Duke of Wimborne, look it up. But yeah, so he's in Macau, he's down on his luck. He previously had embezzled a huge amount of money from this wealthy old woman, and Tilda Swinton plays his private investigator that's hot on his heels. It's adapted from a book of the same name by Lawrence Osborne, which was, you know, huge success, very critically acclaimed. I have to say, I really, really enjoyed this.
Excellent.
I really did get into this because, for one, the setting of Macau is, you know, this gaudy, chintzy, you know, just sensory overload of a place.
Let me interrupt you and tell you that 4 years ago, I was in Macau for a day on a news talk thing. Not they sent me there for gambling or anything.
Sure, sure.
And I've been to Vegas as well. It's possibly the strangest place I've ever been to. It's bizarre. Have you been?
I've been to Vegas. We were going to go to Macau, and I think we kind of stopped ourselves because I think it was just, we were going from like Hong Kong to there, and it felt like it was going to be too much or something. But yeah, no, I mean, the film does it really, really well. It really does bring you into this world. And again, it's that kind of like the seediness and the emptiness of it. It really kind of reminded me of James Toback's The Gambler, if you remember James Caan from the 70s. You know, like just the sea of neon everywhere.
Full of lost souls gambling too.
Exactly. Yeah. And I mean, look, I'm not going to lie, the film does lay it on thick with, you know, the sort of the morality and the whole ghost thing. And there's that whole sort of subplot that, you know, maybe Colin Farrell's character is losing his grip on reality, and he kind of sees himself in reflections and his face is all messed up. And, you know, like it's a very full on film. You know, he really is going full tilt at this. Mm. And Edward Berger, you know, is leaving. There are no subtle notes in this whatsoever. It is very much going straight at it. But again, the film is set in the world of gambling. The game even that they play, Baccarat, is, you know, it's not a game of skill. It's not a game of strategy. It's a complete game of chance and luck. So it makes sense that the film is very much driving straight at you. And when you're watching it, you do feel quite, you know, assaulted by it all. But again, I love that. I love the fact that it was, you know, reaching out to kind of shake me apart from the screen.
Yeah, when you say he's going full tilt, he's gambling and drinking like it's nobody's business, right?
Exactly, yeah. He's completely debauched. And, you know, even the character that he's playing of Lord Doyle is just so over the top, is so ridiculous as to be almost like a comic book character, you know? Mm-hmm. But he does it really, really well. And you can see, you know, when things go his way, you know, he's all gregarious and he's charming. But when he's on his heels, when he's trying to kind of gamble his way out of this, like, you can see the panic, you can see the sweat. And that's always been the thing I think about Colin Farrell, is that, yes, he is a leading man, but, you know, it's that cliche that he's a character actor trapped inside the body of a leading man.
Yeah.
And, you know, we think back to the role that kind of put him on the map, Phone Booth. That, again, is about a character who's this, you know, bravura, PR savvy kind of thing, but is reduced to this blubbering mess. And, you know, Ballad of a Small Player feels like a companion piece to that.
He's very good when he's under pressure, Colin, right? You have to say.
Yeah.
And tell me this, Edward Berger. So he did All Along the Western Front, terrific movie. Conclave, another great movie. He's a great filmmaker based on these three.
Isn't he? Yeah. And he also did a TV series, I don't know if you ever saw it, called Deutschland 83.
Oh, now that's a good while ago. But that, from what I remember, that was brilliant.
Yeah, it was a cracker of a show. Yeah, it was brilliant. Yeah. And people should seek it out. I'm nearly sure it's on the RTE player, but it's absolutely worth a watch. It's all about this Stasi agent that's sent into West Germany. And it's fantastic. But he was involved heavily with that. Yeah, he's a real stylist, I think. Like, he's really got a really sharp eye for, you know, placing characters inside of these richly developed worlds. Like, obviously in Conclave, you know, it's set inside the Vatican, but it doesn't look, it's not that it doesn't look like the Vatican, but it almost feels like they're in a prison, you know, that sort of way, a prison of their own making. And then this, you know, Macau is just this monster that is always in the background, is always like bearing down on top of Colin Farrell's character.
Yeah.
And, you know, it feels oppressive. It feels like a real assault on the senses as you're watching it. But that's the point, you know?
Yeah. So look, we might have redeemed this week's new releases. What are you going to say stars-wise for Ballad of a Small Player?
I will go 3.5 out of 5.
Oh, I thought you were going to give it 4. But
it's close to it. I mean, I do think the ending has a bit of... I have a bit of problem with the ending of it. And I do think it kind of overplays its hand, no pun intended, a little bit.
Okay. Well, that's a good pun if you want to make it.
Yeah, definitely enjoyable though.
Okay. We don't have time, but Roofman is also in cinemas. It's all about a guy robbing McDonald's. Strange movie. Getting great reviews. What would you say stars-wise for Roofman?
I'll go 3 out of 5. It's a change of pace for Derek Keane, for Answer to Blue Valentine. Channing Tatum and Kirsten Dunst saved this. Yeah, really kind of lovely, sweet, kind of like an action comedy, kind of like a romantic comedy as well.
Okay, so to recap, Brian Lloyd gave 3.5 stars for a very quickly reviewed Roofman, 3.5 stars to Ballad of a Small Player, 2 for Black Phone 2, and also 2 for the much talked about but somewhat disappointing After the Hunt. Now, if we haven't set you up for the cinema this weekend, I don't know what to say. Brian Lloyd, entertainment journalist and host of Screenland Podcast. Brian, thanks a million.
Thank you.
Now, after the break, we're going to find out if you can, in fact, kill the bogeyman. Now, you're welcome back to Screen Time. It's spooky. It's Halloween time. Wait till you hear this. I have a book in front of me, which is one of the best book titles for a film or any movie or any book generally. You Can't Kill the Bogeyman. That's the title of Wayne Byrne's new book. And the subtitle is The Ongoing Halloween Saga. Great title. 13 movies and counting. Wayne has been on the show many times because he's written many books, including a brilliant book on the Maverick director Walter Hill. And the last film book he spoke to us about was all about the Nightmare on Elm Street series. This is obviously all about the Halloween series, which began back in 1978 with Michael Myers. And there have now been 13 movies and there will probably be more. Wayne's new book, You Can't Kill the Bogeyman, is just out. It was launched on the 16th of October. Wayne, welcome to studio.
Thanks for having me back, John. It's a pleasure.
You write books the way some people have, what's the right analogy? Haircuts. That might be good, actually, wouldn't it? And you could do with a haircut, Wayne. Ha, ha, ha.
Well, you know, I used to be a hairdresser, so it's kind of part of my thing, the analogy.
You were actually a hairdresser, weren't you?
I was, back in the day, 20-odd years ago.
Wow, you never know what a life has in store. Now you write film books and other books. So look, the obvious question is, what? So you dove deep on Elm Street, and we had great fun talking about that series, and you kind of reminded people that, you know, the narrative of they're all crap after the first one. It's not like that at all. Was it the same motivation for Halloween? That because there's 13 movies, there can be a sense the first one was good, the last three weren't bad, everything else was crap. You tell me.
Well, the main reason I decided to take on this project was because of Part 3.
Right.
Part 3, which is kind of the outlier of the whole series because it has nothing to do with the Michael Myers mythology. It
was
the one kind of... See, the whole idea from the get-go with John Carpenter was he wanted every Halloween movie to be a completely different story.
Yeah.
There was no intention for this whole...
Almost like a Twilight Zone Halloween story kind of thing.
Yeah, an anthology kind of situation. Yeah. So because the first one did so well, you know, it was like an indie, you know, behemoth. It became one of the most financially successful independent film of all time for many years.
Wow.
So that became a phenomenon. So of course then, you know, people want more of that.
Yeah.
So for the next film, they wanted to continue the Michael Myers strand. And Carpenter resisted that, so he wasn't really involved, you know, in terms of the screenplay, perhaps, and executive production, but not as a director. So he was kind of hands-off. But when it got to the third one, Carpenter, at that point, had enough power to say, let's go back to the original idea of the anthology, and we'll do this.
Yeah.
The Nigel Neal script, who was famous.
And Michael Myers... who's the centre of most of these movies, isn't in that one at all.
He's not. It's actually about an evil Irish toy maker who wants to have the hills run red with the blood of animals and children, like in the old Celtic days, you know. So he's a kind of a warlock kind of individual.
So I'm surprised that you like that movie so much, because my memory of that is there's a lot of paddywhackery in it.
There is. And there's actually, there's less from the script. The original script supposedly was very anti-Irish from Nigel Neal, but Tommy Lee Wallace, the director, had to kind of tone it down to make it more palatable.
Okay.
You know, so, but it's a fun, very original unique film, and it was the first Halloween film that I saw when
at something like the age of five, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, if Tusla are listening, they should probably take your father to task, but...
Yes, I remember the day perfectly well. I was coming home from school and my dad said he taped a film off the television for me called Halloween. Mm. And it was, you know, when I got home and watched it, it was Halloween 3. And, you know, mind blown, this is amazing, what is this, you know. But I was already watching movies quite a bit at that stage, you know, thanks to my dad, because he would show me the, you know, the westerns and stuff that he would have at home.
So, at the age of five or six?
Yep.
Wow. Yeah,
so that's, I guess that's why I'm doing these books, you know, because it started very early on.
Absolutely.
And then because that year saw the release of Halloween 4 on VHS, and then Halloween 5 pretty much came almost straight away after that. So yeah. I was geared up now. So when I went to the VHS, to the video shop, if I saw Halloween, I'd be like, oh, and we need to get that. So I'd get my dad to get it for me, you know. So I didn't start off with the whole Michael Myers thing. I just thought, Halloween, get it. You know, then kind of worked my way backwards. So it was like Halloween 3, 4, 5, and then go back to 1 and 2 and just fell in love with the whole franchise. How I ended up doing the book was because of the Elm Street book. That seemed to do well, you know, and they kind of got eyes on it and me.
Yeah.
So agents were like, can you do more of that? You know, so...
But you were happy to write about Halloween because it contains multitudes.
Yeah, exactly. I had to have a personal connection to it because I was offered other franchises first. And I kind of had to think, well, do I want to spend a year or a year and a half just with these movies?
Yeah.
That's what I tend to do. You know, once I'm contracted to do a book, it's kind of all in. I kind of batted away a few of the other franchises.
Okay.
But when it came to Halloween, I was like, that I can do because like Elm Street, I had that kind of emotional connection to the franchise.
And there's a lot to Halloween, as your book points out. You can tell us off air what those other franchises were that you wouldn't dine to write about, but let's hold off. The original Halloween, in a way, it reminds me somewhat of like the first Terminator movie, in that people forget because it's become this very successful franchise and sometimes mocked franchise. But the first John Carpenter Halloween movie, now I haven't seen it in a while, but it's a very, it's almost, dare I say it, a piece of art. Like it's a dark masterpiece.
I would say it's one of the perfect films, like Citizen Kane, where it's, you know, the aesthetics, the collaborations, everything about it, there's nothing to fault, I find, in it at all. And I think that's why it has become this kind of cultural behemoth, because it's, you can't really date it. You know, some other films from that period, they're quite dated because, you know, I don't know, it could be the filmmaking style or something about them pins them to late 70s. But I think with Carpenter's very distinctive style and his collaborations with Dean Cundey as the cinematographer and the editing and everything, it's just, it is a perfect film, and it kind of transcends the 70s.
You know?
I think that's why it comes back constantly, and that's why I kind of cheekily titled it, you know, the ongoing Halloween saga.
Absolutely. Because
even though it ends with Halloween Ends, it'll be back.
It certainly will. And just for the uninitiated, right, Halloween has as its source Michael Myers, who is this escaped lunatic, for want of a better phrase. That's probably not language you can use today. And there, and I know your book doesn't spend too much time on it because lots been written about it, but there are all sorts of theories. And, you know, some people talk about this Dostoevsky and Nothing Man, or even the Beatles sing about that. Like Carpenter originally saw him as a canvas for everything, nearly, or for nothing, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, and that's why, you know, as the series progressed and they started explaining him and explaining background, some fans love it, some fans hate it, you know. I like all the various strands of the franchise, but Carpenter wanted him to be purely and utterly blank, motiveless evil, you know, which is scarier than anything because you can't explain it, you can't reason with it. And as you say, it's kind of like the Terminator. It's just an unstoppable force.
Yeah.
It's elemental. But when Rob Zombie did his version, he went the complete opposite. He went into a whole kind of sociological, abusive family background, which, you know, broke it down, his mental state, to the result of a father who was horrible to him and a mother who was quite absent. You know, so it really got into more deeper territory there.
And those Rob Zombie movies were... Carpenter definitely would not have approved of those, right?
No.
Carpenter wanted him to be, as you say, free-floating evil, where a zombie kind of sociologicalized it and psychologicalized it up and all that kind of thing.
Yeah, and even some of the sequels, which was another strand where they made Jamie Lee Curtis's character his sister.
Yeah.
That wasn't in the first film.
Yeah.
You know, it was just she was a babysitter that night that he came home.
And
she was a target, as her friends were. But in the second one, they made it that it was his sister. So 4, 5, and 6, 7, and 8 kind of continue that strand as well.
Yeah.
So, you know, again, it's kind of explaining him, because then now he's targeting his family.
Mm.
So that's his reason. That's his motive.
And in a weird kind of way, it foreshadows all these Marvel multi-universes, because there's conflicting storylines in the Halloween genre now at this stage. In terms of the book, so you don't talk to Carpenter and Curtis. I know you might have reached out to them and stuff, but time did not allow and all. But as you do in most of your books, you get behind, like, you talk to a lot of the cinematographers, some of the directors, some of the musicians that I want to talk to you about. So in a way, because in the horror world, you know, these movies are very important, we've heard Carpenter and Curtis a lot on them before, and it's a Google away.
Yeah.
But you spoke to some people we don't usually hear about.
Well, that was another way in for me. You know, I said from the very beginning, if I'm going to do this book, I'm going to do it the way I do all my books, which is really to kind of celebrate the people behind the films, and kind of I treat every interview almost as if I'm writing their biography. You know, I want to hear of where they came from, what the culture was like, and how they discovered film and what influenced them. You know, to me that's more interesting than just kind of expanding on or speculating on the Michael Myers mythology,
you know,
which I'm sure some people would prefer I did. But to me, it's a mix of thematic analysis, film criticism, and production information, you know. So that was my way in. And I think had I interviewed Carpenter and Curtis, I would have known the answers to my questions already.
Yeah.
Because they have been
absolutely
in so many documentaries and, you know, widely written about. And I just thought it was more exciting to kind of hear these new stories, or at least new to me, you know. And I got some people on the record who had never really talked about.
Such as?
Peter Lyons-Collister, for example, a cinematographer on Part 4. After Part 4, he went on to a huge career making big studio films. So he's never really kind of stopped to kind of reflect on his little horror movie from 1988, you know. But one of the things that has happened after all these books I've done is I've kind of built up a good network of connections in Hollywood. So if I need to talk to someone, generally I know someone who can connect me. So with
your Hollywood connection, haven't taught you how to turn off a phone during a radio interview, but that's okay. This is live radio. This is what happens. And tell me this, what was his, was making Four, because by that stage the franchise had possibly lost the run of itself a bit. What was his experience in making Four?
When he looks back at it now, he can kind of sees what was he did well about it, but he also sees the flaws, you know. But like I say, since then he's become this kind of Hollywood cinematographer.
Yeah.
So he's kind of seeing, oh, well, I could have done that better. We didn't have enough money there, so I maybe went a bit too far with the blacks or something like that.
Yeah.
Looking back from a technical point of view, he sees the flaws.
Mm.
Now, you know, I think it's a great film. I don't necessarily see the flaws he sees, but then again, he's the one who composed these images and was kind of restricted by budget and time and everything else. So those little things are fascinating to me.
Absolutely.
Because we take a lot of this for granted. It's the stuff we enjoy.
Harvey Weinstein, who has a very problematic legacy in a lot of, for lots of very obvious reasons, he also screwed up Halloween a bit as well, right?
Yeah, Halloween became part of, it was owned by Miramax and the Weinstein Company for a few films. And various filmmakers involved didn't have a good time with them because, you know, Harvey Scissorhands, as he was known, was prone to meddle in the production of films and in the final cut. And there are several stories in there, both from directors' point of views, actors' point of views, composers' point of views, where they had to redo things, they had to kind of change them up, but they had to cut out whole scenes, reshoot scenes. There's a famous example of Part 6. There's two versions of Part 6 because one is completely different to the other. One was the theatrical version and the other is what they call the producer's cut. And it's like two completely different entities.
And the producer's cut was released subsequently?
Only recently,
Right.
For years it was only available as a bootleg, like collector's conventions, you know.
Prince's Black Album.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. A terrible print. But then some of the boutique Blu-ray labels released it properly during recent years, and it's kind of found a new audience who can see what it was originally meant to be for the Weinsteins.
Right.
Went to town on it.
Tell me this then, like 10 years ago, it's reinvigorated around by Blumhouse and we get Jamie Lee Curtis back and the story takes up from 1978. So you tell me though, because I haven't seen, and I'm not going to lie, I haven't seen when we get up to 6, 7, 8, 9, the narrative tends to be the first movie was great, then it was diminishing returns, and now they're great again. So is there any truth in that?
To a degree, in that it happened in 1998 as well, when Jamie Lee Curtis came back for Halloween H20.
Yes, the 20th.
That was when it was still under the Weinsteins at that stage, but this was post-Scream, and they were kind of playing into that kind of ironic, you know, horror was big business again because of Scream.
Yeah.
So they kind of played into that element of it, and but then it, you know, they wrapped it up with the following film, then it was Rob Zombie's two films, and then in 2018, they brought it back again.
Mm.
And it was, I think, because Curtis was back and Carpenter was involved on some level.
Yeah.
It kind of gave it a certain weight in the culture and with film fans and all that. And it does jump off the first film.
Yeah.
So she's not his sister in it.
Yeah.
She is just this, he's trying to, you know, stalk the woman he fails to kill in the first film. And that's his whole sole motivation.
Yeah.
You know, so there's none of the whole family mythology. There's none of the sociological stuff or anything like that. It's just this masked monster.
Yeah.
And it's a very, very well put together film. You know, it's had money behind it, you know.
Yeah. And Carpenter's blessing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And that meant
and the two subsequent sequels had Carpenter's blessing?
Yeah, that whole trilogy was kind of, you know, because Blumhouse had gotten to the point where they were established and well respected within the horror community.
Mm.
And again, I think mainly because of Jamie Lee Curtis's involvement, you know, it kind of lent just this gravity to it that some of the other sequels didn't have.
Yeah.
And the second one, I actually think is the best of the three. It's my favorite of the three. And I think because it didn't
have... That's called
Halloween Kills.
Halloween Kills, yeah.
And it didn't have the weight of either the first one kind of rejuvenating it or the last one wrapping everything up. It was just a really good placeholder. And that could have went either way, you know, because you know it's just filling the gap.
Yeah.
You know, but I think it was just a really fun Halloween sequel, not bringing any kind of expectations to the table, you know. So it's an interesting trilogy. I mean, the last film isn't terribly good. And it was a bit of a disappointing wraparound. Mm,
considering how good the first two had been.
Yeah.
You say in the subtitle, the ongoing saga, 13 movies and counting, that was called Halloween Ends. Is it not over?
Well, there's talk of a TV show. There's there's a video game coming out.
Okay.
And I'm sure there's always methods and ways of rebooting the franchise, depending on who has the rights at any given time and how they want to proceed with that.
It's made, I checked this morning, it's not far off $1 billion, right, in total.
Oh yeah, $1 billion franchise.
Yeah, so you would imagine they're going to breathe new life into it at some stage down the road, because that's what Hollywood does. I seem to ask you this often when you're in, talking about these various movies and various directors or cinematographers. If you had to give me a top three for the uninitiated, if you wanted to watch Halloween movies, and there are 13 of them.
Halloween 1,
of course, which is just called Halloween.
Yeah.
John Carpenter's original, 1978.
Yeah, absolute masterpiece.
Yeah.
External of the franchise and everything else, just as a piece of American cinema, it is a supreme work of art. Halloween 3, because it's time now to kind of give it its due. Been 40 years of people going, no, there's no Michael Myers in it. It's nothing to do with the franchise. Don't think of it as, you know, it not having Michael Myers. Just think of it as a, just another great horror film from the 80s, very underrated.
Is it set in Illinois?
No, it's set in an Irish village in Northern California.
That's right, it's the Irish hook,
And it stars the great Irish Wexford-born actor Dan O'Hurley.
Yeah.
He's one of my favourite actors, and he actually relishes the role here as the evil Irish toymaker, you know. And then Halloween 4.
Okay.
The one we mentioned, because I think it's just it's a masterclass on how to do a sequel, again, without the expectation of, well, you're following a masterpiece. It's just, it's a different set of filmmakers here. Carpenter not involved. You know, the only connection really is Alan Howarth, the composer, who retains the tone of the series.
And just as a footnote, the Rob Zombie movies, interesting mistakes, or do they stand up today?
Very interesting. The first one, because of the backstory, I think is really interesting, because the kind of the thematic true line in all of my books is there's kind of a sociological interest. It's it's what really kind of gravitates me to cinema. So I'm interested in that plot element of it, or the subtext. It's a bit excessive for me, especially the second one.
It's very violent, isn't it?
Very.
Yeah.
And he didn't have a pleasant experience on the first film because of the Weinsteins and very other corporate interests involved. So when he didn't want to do the second one, I believe, but when Malik Akkad did convince him, he was like, you can make the movie you want to make. And he went and made a zombie movie. It was hardcore. It's quite unpleasant. It's a bit too much for me in terms of the violence, but stylistically, very interesting. I mean, Rob Zombie he has a very distinctive style, and fair play to him for that, because even regardless of all the corporate meddling on the first film or whatever, he's still able to go, this is my film.
Mm.
You know, he has an authorial stamp on it, which, you know, has to be applauded.
The book is called You Can't Kill the Bogeyman. The Bogeyman, by the way, refers to Michael Myers as opposed to Harvey Weinstein, but you can make whatever connections you want. And the subtitle is very clever. The ongoing Halloween saga, 13 movies and counting. It's by Wayne Byrne, who's written many, many books. It's out. It's just published this Thursday, just gone. So do check it out. It's on the Bloomsbury imprint. You're moving up in the world.
Indeed.
They're serious book people. Wayne, I have to ask, you're always writing books. What's the next one?
There's three in the works.
Oh my God.
And there's another one coming out in a couple of months. So that is The Evolution of American Film Music, 1960 to 1990.
And wow.
I co-wrote that with my friend Amanda Kramer, who is the keyboardist of the Psychedelic Furs. That's the next one coming out.
And that's a fascinating time for film music.
Yeah, really kind of going from the new Hollywood era, which was, you know, it was kind of an end of exclusive orchestration and classical
music. Songs coming in.
Songs came in, and it was a different time. So we go from that new Hollywood era up through the no wave period, which was the kind of early art house indie underground happening in New York. And then we go into kind of the commercial 80s end. So the introduction of synthesizers and the big soundtrack compilation.
The heat is on.
Absolutely, yeah. So there's that's coming out next. And then there's three in the works, which are one is a follow up to my other book on Amanda, Hired Guns, Portraits of Women in Alternative Music. This time we're doing the men.
Okay.
So it's the male hired guns, so to speak. Then the other one is I'm doing a book which is on kind of a sociological film criticism of films of a certain area, which I'm co-writing with my friend Carolina Chara. So we're not interviewing anybody, any directors. We're not going behind the scenes. It's purely analytical. I kind of started that in response to the intensity of working on the Halloween book, because I just wanted to write a book where I didn't have to sit up at 3 o'clock in the morning interviewing somebody in Hollywood.
Yeah,
you know, it's just something.
Do one for you for a change.
Exactly.
Well, as I say, his new book, You Can't Kill the Bogeyman, the ongoing Halloween saga of 13 movies and counting, is now out. Wayne Byrne, a pleasure. Thanks.
Thanks, John. Thanks for having me.
That is it for this week. Next week on the show, we're going to go deep Springsteen, because the new biopic is out, and we're going to be doing a special where we're looking at some of the best musical biopics of all time. So tune in for that. In the meantime, I'll just wish you a happy remainder to your weekend. Remind you that this show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com or the Newstalk app powered by Go Loud, or wherever you get your podcasts. And of course, it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. Get in touch with me at any stage about whatever movies or TV shows you're watching and enjoying or not. You can email me screentime@newstalk.com. Thank you for listening. Have a safe week ahead, and I will talk to you all next week.
Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2 times the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18 plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8-6-25 and 1-5-26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointstc.